Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, welcome to the Daily Jungle. We had a ton of show today. Three great interviews. SI's John Wertheim talked about Japanese baseball phenom Shohei Ohtani. Texas Longhorns football coach Tom Herman came in. He gave us an update on his team before Saturday's spring game and another tremendous conversation with LA Dodgers legend Clayton Kershaw. All that and my all-important Stanley Cup hockey preview. Alvy, do what you do. Let me start with the NBA. Let me start with this would-be controversy involving the Dallas Mavericks and Tony Romo. It's one of the hot-button topics. Hot takers all over this all morning long. You've probably seen that story too. Mark Cuban wanted Tony Romo to play last night. In fact, he went as far as to tell NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, "I'm going to do it." Quote, "Fine me if you don't like it." So Cuban was determined to get that done. He wanted to not only honor Tony Romo and give him his own night, but he wanted to give him his own uniform. He wanted to play him last night in a game. Well, Silver did not like it. Remember, Cuban said, "Fine me if you don't like it." Well, Silver didn't like it. He said the contract that Cuban wanted to give Romo would not be honored. So that did not happen. Now, they went ahead and they honored him anyway, and they made him a Maverick for a day. And whereas head coach Rick Carlisle did not sound like he was really up for the team, going to all the trouble of signing Romo to an actual contract and letting him run in an actual game, Carlisle was all in about acknowledging him and giving Romo his due.
We're honored to have Tony with us. He has stood for all the things that great Dallas athletes stand for. Great competitor, winner, plays hurt, you know, the whole thing. And he's been a great supporter of the Mavericks and a good friend to myself, Dirk, Mark, and so many of us. So we want to see if he would be willing to do this. And we're very happy that he was enthusiastically accepting.
See, I think that's sincere. I think he meant that. I think that's sincere. And I think that's all true. And I've got no problem with it. He is all those things. And to me, what's whack are people freaking out, screaming, "Why does this guy deserve all of this? What has this guy ever won? He's not a Hall of Famer. Why the hell are they honoring him?" Well, for all the reasons Carlisle just mentioned, ring or no ring, yellow jacket or no yellow jacket, he is one of the most popular athletes in that city's history. The fans love him. The Mavericks owner loves him. The coach loves him. Some of the guys on that team have a tight relationship with him, including Dirk.
Also, we're here to celebrate and honor my good friend Tony Romo. Yes. Thanks for everything you've done for Dallas. And you represented us great. We're all proud of you. So thank you very much. Go, Tony Romo.
I'd even add to that that Romo himself is frequently seen at the games. He loves that team. So if they want to honor that guy, who the hell cares? Their team, their call, their night. And not only do I not have a problem with that, or the fact that they rolled out the red carpet for him, I literally would not have had a problem with him actually playing in a game last night. One non-playoff team playing another non-playoff team in the final home game of the year really isn't going to hurt anybody. For all intents and purposes, that's an exhibition game. So say this nonsense about how he's taking away a spot from a more deserving player. From who? From who? Some D-leaguer that you've never heard of and don't care about? And no, it's not going to set a bad precedent or open up a Pandora's box. Golden State is not going to see something like that. Not going to see Romo run up and down the floor a couple of times in an NBA game and then decide to put Derek Carr out there. It's not going to open up the floodgates. Every team in the NBA is not going to start doing it. It's a one-off in a game that really doesn't matter, that people really would not have been talking about otherwise. To me, it would have been harmless. The biggest thing is, you don't want to put Romo or the other players on the court in jeopardy because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing or where to go or what to do. And I think that's probably not the case, especially if Caron Butler is saying that he thinks that Romo would have played in the NBA if he wanted to. So, to me, I don't buy that rap that letting him do it would be like disrespecting the game or making a mockery of the NBA or turning it into a joke. I mean, are you watching NBA games right now? Are you watching the games this week? Are you watching the teams that aren't in it? They're tanking for ping pong balls. They're running dudes out there who used to play for the Fort Wayne Mad Ants. and the Maine Red Claws. Trust me, Romo is no more embarrassing than all that. And really, to me, not embarrassing at all. I think Cuban's right when he says, quote, anybody who thinks a layup line is disrespectful hasn't watched an NBA game. We've got people shooting half courts at every break. We've got kids for ball boys. We're entertainment. And if they're so self-important that they can't recognize that, it's on them, not me. I don't agree with everything he says, but I agree with that. He's right about that. I actually would have loved to have seen that kind of game. Would not have bothered me at all. It would not have been disrespectful or made a mockery of anything. Look at the games that are being played right now by teams that are not in it and tell me what's a mockery. 1-800-636-8686. Where'd he come out on that? Would you like to have seen him in a game, or is that a bad precedent? Or is Cuban right when he says, man, everybody's taking themselves way too seriously? Clayton Kershaw joins us. Clayton, it's nice to have you back on the show. How are you?
I'm doing good, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you, Clayton. Thank you. If you could go back to opening day, if we could start right there, you had another great outing. That brings you down to 5-0 with an ERA of under 1 in opening day starts. You're tied with Don Drysdale for the franchise record for most wins on opening day. So what's it like to take the ball on opening day, and then what's it mean to hear your name and Don Drysdale's mentioned together?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. You know, I think anytime you get to pitch on opening day is special regardless, and then you add into the fact that you're doing it for the Dodgers with the history that they have, and something I definitely don't take for granted. You know, it's a very special thing.
You know, it seems like every single season obviously is different, but the team brought back the majority of last year's team. Dave Roberts now is in his second season as the manager. So how would you describe the culture and the attitude around the team this year?
It's great, man. You know, we came so close last year, and we pretty much had the same team back with a few awesome additions, you know, Logan Forsyth and Gutierrez and left. And, you know, we got a lot more guys healthy, myself included. So it's a great team, and Doc's awesome. You know, he's got such a good pulse of the team, knows what he needs to say when he needs to say it. And it's just a lot of fun around here right now.
Los Angeles Dodger Clayton Kershaw, our guest, you just mentioned it. You came so close last season, so close to reaching the World Series. So when you look back on last year's postseason, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Yeah, I mean, you know, failure is no fun. You know, I've gotten to fail a few times in the postseason, obviously. So it's never fun. You know, hopefully you learn from it and, you know, get some experience. So for the next time, you're more prepared. But that's probably the company line. You know, I think that at the end of the day, it's not fun to lose. And we're excited, you know, being here for the ring ceremony and the World Series stuff for the Cubs. This, you know, I got to thank the schedule makers for that one. It's pretty special, obviously. So get to see that and rub it in our faces a little bit. But, you know, it's maybe a little bit more motivation for us. And we like our chances this year, though, and I'm excited about it.
Well played. Well played. Hey, listen, I would imagine also the company line's got to be, we're looking forward and we're not looking back. But if I can get you to look back for one moment, if you go back to that relief appearance against the Nationals in Game 5 of the NLDS, Kenley Jansen's on the mound. You had told Rick Honeycutt, the pitching coach, you felt great. He said, quote, no way. Then you speak to Dave Roberts, and he said, quote, no way. So at what point did you decide that you were going into that game, and then what was it like to walk out to the mound that night?
Yeah, it was a crazy night. So much fun, obviously, to get to be on the top, the good side of that. But, you know, it kind of happened in the seventh inning. You know, we saw Kenley going in the game, and I was sitting there talking with Chase Utley, and, you know, Chase was like, you know, it's going to be tough for Kenley to pitch three innings. I was like, you're right. What are we going to do? You know? And he was like, well, if you think you can do it, you should probably go tell him. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right. So I went and talked to him, and yeah, just what they said no way. And negotiations started happening. And I said, well, let me go try and get loose and make sure I feel good and go from there. And they said, okay. And yeah, it just kind of happened really quick, actually.
I mean, is adrenaline, or was there a different feeling when you went back out there? I mean, 2 days before, you'd made 110 pitches. What's it like to enter that game at that time, something you really never done before, not on a stage like that?
Yeah, I mean, adrenaline's definitely carrying you through that. And, you know, you just kind of throw everything out the window. You know, it's not your routine. You never throw on the bullpen and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, you got to get two outs. And that's what I just kept telling myself was, you know, it's still pitching. Just go out there and get two outs. And thankful that it worked out.
We're talking to Clayton Kershaw for another couple of minutes. You know, a group of major leaguers were asked, what's it like to face you? Daniel Murphy called it, quote, unpleasant. Jose Altuve said, don't even talk about it. I don't like facing him. Adam Eaton said he had nightmares after the first time he faced you. I would imagine as somebody who competes, it's probably gratifying to hear that. If I turn that thing on its head, are there any batters that kind of give you that same sense? Would you say that about anybody you have to face?
That's funny. The three guys you mentioned, I feel like they've got a ton of hits off of me. So they're just being nice right now. But, you know, I think it's, yeah, it's always awesome to hear your peers, you know, if they have respect for what you do on the mound. And, you know, I think that's one of the big reasons why we play this game is for the respect of our teammates and our peers. And it's a pretty special thing. As far as hitters go, I mean, there's a lot of guys that give me problems. You know, I mean, I think you mentioned, I think Daniel Murphy, he's one of the tougher at-bats in the game right now. Just seems like he's on every pitch. And, you know, historically, Dexter Fowler's always given me a really hard time. He's got great numbers against me and still trying to figure out how to get him out. So those are some of the two off the top of my head that I really feel like give me a hard time.
Hey, Clones, let me get at you for a minute about Ferguson. Ferguson is the nation's largest distributor of plumbing products, but their playbook goes deeper than plumbing. Pro contractors know to depend on Ferguson for the best in waterworks, HVAC, and facilities maintenance products in the game. Ferguson has over 20,000 knowledgeable associates always working for you. Combine that with Ferguson's 1,400 locations and 24/7 online ordering, and you will always have the home team advantage. See why the pros pick Ferguson at Ferguson.com today. That's Ferguson. Now it's back to the Daily Jungle. We're talking to Clayton Kershaw. You know, Clayton, you and I have talked about the relationship you have with Sandy Koufax and the fact that you have so many conversations with him. I could ask you any number of things about Sandy, but let me ask you this. What's your reaction when you see his curveball grip and the way he wraps his fingers around the ball?
Yeah, I mean, it's special. His hands are so big, so much bigger than mine. And it's just funny when he shows you, well, here's how I did it. And, you know, he's definitely not one of those guys where, you know, here's how I did it, this is the right way to do it, but he just wants to help. And, you know, you show him some curveball grips and what he used to do. And, you know, you listen to him and you're like, okay, I really want to do that. But at the end of the day, I mean, no one can grip a baseball like that. His hands are just, I mean, he wraps, his whole hand covers the baseball. So you try and take little nuggets here and there, but at the end of the day, there's a reason that he's Sandy Koufax and we're not.
You had your first spring training ping pong for purpose event on March 4th in Arizona, and the event benefits the Kershaw Challenge and the projects that you support. You have players from across the league who are invited. 50% of the proceeds go to your challenge. The other 50% go to the charity of the winner's choice. You and your partner won. I've seen the photos. You were going all out. Was there anybody who gave you a decent challenge?
Man, that was such a fun event. You know, we have done some ping pong tournaments in the past in L.A., and you know, ping pong is kind of in the culture of baseball. It's in people's clubhouses, and it was such a great time. We got other teams involved this year in spring training, and it worked out really well for the first one. So we're hoping it continues and we get to do that. And yeah, me and Scott Van Slyke, my partner, we did win, and we played Robbie Ray and Grinke of the Diamondbacks. So it was a good game, but I'm really thankful, you know, Zach being my former teammate, that I beat him, because I didn't want to hear about that. So I'm glad we got him.
Of course. Now, the Kershaw Challenge is supporting four organizations this year around the globe. So what's it mean to you and Ellen that you're able to have an impact in Los Angeles, Dallas, the Dominican Republic, and Zaire?
Yeah, Zambia. I mean, it is amazing just what we've been able to do with the platform that baseball's given us. You know, I realize that baseball is such a gift, you know, and trying to do everything I possibly can to use that platform to help other people, because at the end of the day, you know, baseball is going to end, and you know, we're going to be able to affect a lot of people through it. So really give a lot of credit to Ellen. You know, she's the one that kind of had the vision for it and kind of has started this whole thing. And I've been able just to kind of be alongside her as she runs this whole thing.
You know, one last thought. I mean, certainly none of us could ever do what you can do, but at the same time, you know, there's that great equalizer. We do have one thing in common. A lot of us are parents, and I know that you and Ellen welcome the arrival of your second child, a son named Charlie. So what's life now like with two youngsters?
Man, it's a handful. You know, we're on our first road trip right now, and Ellen went back home to Dallas, and just talking with her about two kids, and it's hard to explain other than it is such a handful, but it is the best thing in the world. And Charlie's the man. He's awesome. Him and Callie, they're so much fun, and Charlie's a big boy. He's a monster. So I'm excited about, you know, what that's going to look like, having a little son to teach all sorts of sports too. So it's been a lot of fun so far, and, you know, it's just a huge blessing.
16 teams squaring off in the fiercest postseason in all of sports. Every game a battle. Every shift a battle. Every minute, every second a battle. Every series a bloodbath. And all for the right for some bearded warriors to hoist Lord Stanley's Cup. Hey, look, you might not be a hockey person. You might not be a hockey person, but you should be a playoff hockey person, because there's nothing in sports that delivers like the next four rounds of hockey. And after a fairly vanilla end to the regular season, we now enter the postseason with a wide open bracket. Maybe a dozen of those teams are legitimate contenders to win the cup. And there are a few storylines that you simply cannot ignore that I want to throw out there before I get to my pick. Starting with the young guns, Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, a couple of generational talents that are taking that league by storm. And it's not too soon to say that. They are generational talents. Two young stars about to get their first taste of playoff hockey. How are these guys going to handle the pressure cooker that is playoff hockey? And then how do they build on the historic starts to their careers? Starting with McDavid. Literally may not be another player like him to ever play in the league. The NHL scoring champ is 20. Only the fifth guy since 1990 to score 100 points in a season before he turned 21. The kid with the C on his sweater already just brought Edmonton back to the playoffs after the longest drought in the NHL. This guy's to hockey players what Russell Westbrook is to Hoopers. Hell, what Usain Bolt is to track and field. The freakiest athlete in a game filled with genetic all-stars. A guy that scouts and coaches already think is the fastest guy ever to lace him up. A blend of size and speed and skill that nobody's ever seen. Already one of the scarier guys one-on-one in the game. Then you have Matthews, who's doing his own trailblazing. The rookie who was the number one overall pick in the 2016 draft grew up playing hockey in Scottsdale. Not in some Canadian province. Scottsdale. And he's fast-tracked Toronto's rebuild. The first teenage rookie to score 40 goals since some cat named Mario Lemieux did it. And if McDavid wows you with singular speed and skill, Matthews makes you shake your head that there's a kid that grew up in the desert playing on mini rinks in Arizona who's still just 19, and he plays the game like a seasoned vet who's dominated for a decade and not just a few months. Two storylines right there. Two guys you have to watch. So now I've got to get to my pick. And before I do, let me tell you once again, I don't take these powers, and they are powers. I don't take them lightly. Can't say how many people I've run into over the weekend or at one of Jake or Logan's baseball games, even in traffic on the 5 freeway, and they just keep hammering away. Rome, Rome, Rome. Who's your pick this year? Who's going to win the cup? Rome, I'm going to Vegas. Who have you got? I need to get paid. I mean, honestly, it's exhausting. It's starting to wear me out. It's starting to suck the life out of me. The other day, there's this goon in a tinted out pickup redlining his Hemi V12. Stop and go on the freeway. Dude is road raging. He cuts 5 lanes across traffic, slams the brakes, staring out the window. I mean, yelling at me, pointing at me. And I'm like, what, bro? What? What did I do? What did I do? I'm on the phone and Janet's telling me, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't get caught up. What are you, stupid? What if he has a gun? I'm like, what, man? What? What did I do? I mean, my blood pressure is going through the roof. This guy rolls down his window. He's screaming, gesturing. Fan smack! I need your playoff pick now! This guy burned across like 4 lanes. Nearly set off a 20-car pileup just to get that solid gold lock a few days before the rest of you. But I didn't give it to him. I did not give it to him because I do not take this lightly. It take little Van Smack, growing up in the 818 in the San Fernando Valley, a great hockey mind just laying dormant. My old man looked at me one day. He said, Van Smack, with great power comes responsibility. So I thought about that, actually, as my life flashed before my eyes, before I had to tell that goon who had a lady riding shotgun with lats that looked like Viking wings. Just chill out, brother. Chill out. Now is not the time. Do not road rage over a pick that you're just not getting. Not yet, you're not. Just wait. I wasn't ready then. I'm ready now. You see, I can see the future. And what I see is amazing. It's going to be incredible. The hours of penalty minutes that we're going to see when the Ducks and the Flames put on the armor and they go back to battle. Sidney Crosby at the height of his powers, trying to go back to back for the first time since the 98 Red Wings. The Blackhawks chasing down a dynasty, looking for their fourth cup in 8 years. The one seed in the Western Conference with that core of Patty Kane, Jonathan Toews, Duncan Keith, Marian Hossa, Coach Joel Quenneville, looking to hang one more banner. Who's it going to be? Who am I going to take? What's the guaranteed lock for 2017? Alvin, are you ready to roll it? Are you ready to document it? Because when I'm right again, I want to make sure you all know it. This year, this time, I see the future of the Cup. And I see it in four letters. C-A-P-S. Caps, caps, caps. Yes, I said it. This is finally the year the Washington Capitals shake that gorilla off their back. This is the year Alex Ovechkin hoists the cup. Year after year after year of disappointment. Playoff disasters. Catastrophes. This year, it's going to be different. Trust me. I know it hasn't been easy. I know they haven't even made it out of the second round since Ovechkin came to town. And I know Barry Trotz has not won a second round series either. But all those reps, all those raps, all that heartache, it's just fuel for this run to the title. This isn't last year's Caps. And this time, they're going to get through Pittsburgh. This time, a Penguins team that's just too banged up to keep up with the most well-rounded and dangerous team in hockey is not going to take them out. The ingredients are all there. The President's Trophy winners have everything you need. A Vezina winner in the nets, the league's stingiest defense, an elite offense. Top to bottom, they've got skill. They can carry the puck as well as anybody. They have depth. They have experience. They have grit. They have toughness. And most importantly, they have Alex Ovechkin, ready to get his name etched into the greatest trophy in sports. I've got the Caps beating the Hawks in the Stanley Cup Final. And before you tell me where to put yourself out there, Rome, that's not what this is about. This is about getting it right. And I am never wrong when it comes to the Stanley Cup playoffs. Write it down. There's your pick. Caps. C-A-P-S. Caps. Tyler in Edmonton. Tyler, sincerely, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Rome, you've been good. How you been living, man?
Good, man. While. Great. Awesome.
Well, first off, I got your back with the Caps. Besides the Oilers, I have the Caps as my second choice to win. Mainly so Ovi can finally get his. For a long time up here, Canadian analysts all had some sort of bone to pick with this guy, even though Crosby could be just as much of a bag as anyone. So for all those losers, I want Ovechkin to do some damage. My first prediction is that Anaheim is going to expose those thin-skinned babyface hacks to the south of us. Calgary, you guys are done in six. Let's face it. Goudreau will be an afterthought in a couple years, and Monahan is a complimentary player at best. Your goalie sucks. You guys don't have a chance. Romy, Toronto is already conjuring up excuses as to why they're going to lose. Every single tool that covers that team is already pulling the tried and true. They're playing with house money. What they do from here is just a bonus. It's typical, Rome. How very Toronto of them. How about you guys man up and actually admit that you're good enough to be in the playoffs? But the problem is, we all know you fluked out getting in because the Islanders and Lightning had massive injury problems. And besides that, the rest of your conference is a joke. Toronto, you guys are done in four, and I'd be surprised if you even score five goals in the entire series. Lastly, Jim, I want to remind everyone that we here in Edmonton have the single greatest player in the league, and the rest of Canada doesn't have a hope in hell for the next 20 years, regardless of what they do to their teams. San Jose will be done in five, and when it's all said and done, Logan Couture will be going up in the Rat Family Hall of Fame. War Canada ripping Cal's golden ticket in 2017. I'm out.
Wreck him!
Tom Herman is my guest. Tom, it's great to have you back. What's up? How are you?
I'm doing great, Romy. It sounds like I came in when you were preaching your Nostradamus, I guess, or Nostradamus predictions for NHL hockey. I'm sorry I missed that.
Nostradamus. That's exactly what that is, Tom. I could run it back for you at some point. In fact, you probably didn't miss much at all. Listen, you and I, Tom, I was going to say, spoke shortly after you were named head coach. So bring me up to date. You've been there for a little while right now. What have the first few months been like for you, and have they been what you expected?
It's been like trying to take a sip of water out of a fire hose. I mean, there's so many things that need to be tended to that, there's very little coaching football, to be honest with you. And so, and that's okay. I've hired an unbelievable staff, the best assistant coaching staff in the country. And has it been what I have expected? Yeah. You know, anytime you go three straight seven lost seasons, there's obviously something's wrong and something needs to be fixed, especially at a place like Texas. That Texas should not go three straight seasons with seven losses. And so you've got to, A, find out where the problems are, and then, B, go about implementing plans and, executing those plans to make sure that you fix those problems.
Texas head football coach Tom Herman joins us. You know, Tom, you just said it, that there's very little coaching of football going on right now, or not as much as maybe you'd like to do. So to that point, you know, before we talk about a position battle or anything like that, one of the things that you've talked about is a cultural accountability. What do you mean by that, and then how do you go about developing that?
Well, I think you go about developing it by understanding, one, that this is the most interdependent sport probably ever invented, meaning, it's not like baseball where it's the hitter versus the pitcher, and it's not like basketball where you can say, hey, you four guys go stand on one side of the court and I'm going to go isolate this other guy. I literally can't do my job as a player on offense or defense if the guy next to me doesn't do his job. And so we've got to instill in them that winning is very, very hard. The preparation and the steps that it takes to win championships is monumental. That's why there's only a handful of teams that are in contention every year. You got to have great talent, and you've got to have great coaches that mold that talent. But there's something extra. There's something special in a culture, a championship culture, and that is, when things in preparation or in a game, when they get difficult or they get hard or they get painful or they get inconvenient, that the human nature is to tap out, is to stop or to move on to something else. And we've got to push through all of those things. And the only way to do that, to motivate a human being to do those things, is if you love somebody and if they're like family to you. And I know you've got a wife and kids, and if they were counting on you to do some task and it would be, I'm sure, almost, hey, you're going to have to kill me from keeping me from doing this task. And so that's kind of the familial atmosphere that we try to promote as much as possible here, that you have people that love you and that you say you love in return, counting on you to do your job regardless of circumstance. And anything less than doing your job is unacceptable.
Tom Herman joining us. You know, Tom, what it is, I mean, you're exactly right. It's a big, big, big ask. But those who do it, and those who do it consistently, and if everybody's doing it, are going to have a much greater shot at winning the ultimate prize. But still, it's a big ask, and especially if it's never been asked of a person before. So typically, what is the reaction from this group? Are they resisting on any level? Are they all in? What's it like when you ask them to do something they've never done before, and it's that tough an ask?
Much less defiance than other places I've been. You know, the last place I was at, they were coming off an 8-5 season, and when you totally, flip the script and ask them to do something completely different, I think you get a lot of, sideways looks, like, hey, we weren't that bad. And we're here, it's been a bit refreshing, to be honest with you, Romy, because, these kids are embarrassed. They understand what the level of expectation is at the University of Texas, and that they have not lived up to that. And so I think they're willing to try anything and everything to change that. And I think we started our first team meeting with Einstein's famous quote of, the definition of insanity is repeatedly performing the same act expecting different results. And so if you want different results, you have to change what you're doing. And the buy-in has been pretty good thus far. Now, the execution hasn't been great. I think you know, these guys say they want to, and they legitimately go out and try to be tough and try to be accountable, but we fall short quite a bit. But luckily we don't have to play tomorrow, and we've got months of teaching still left in us before we do have to play.
Texas head football coach Tom Herman joining us here in the jungle. And then, of course, you've got that legendary attention to detail. And to that end, there reportedly is that chart up in the bathroom which measures hydration level in urine. And there are four levels of hydration for those who have not seen this, Tom. There's championship hydration levels, selfish teammate, blatant disregard for your teammates, you're headed to Area 51, and then finally, you are a bad guy. Now, there could be a reaction that if you're paying attention to the color of urine, you're going way over the top. But when you're turning a program around, is there any detail which is too small?
Absolutely not. No. And, you know, I think what people need to realize, hey, you know, that chart is actually, I mean, it's up in every high school I go recruit. It's up in a lot of colleges. So it just happened, I guess, that a reporter stumbled in and took a picture of one. And then, two, I was surprised a little bit, Rome, on how people, you know, react to honesty. You know, I was talking to our SID, John Bianco, who's the best in the business, about, you know, kind of the reaction to that. And it shocks me that if you can't, your muscles are like a piece of steak, and a nice, hydrated, fresh piece of steak is not going to pull and is going to be very pliable. You dehydrate that muscle like beef jerky, and it tears. Same with concussions. Your brain is like 80% water, and science has shown that if your brain is dehydrated, you're more susceptible to risk of concussion. And so it's literally a safety and you know, keeping your body in peak performance issue. And then, you know what? In my opinion, if you can't drink enough water throughout the day to keep your body to where you can perform at a peak level and a level of championship for your teammates, then that is selfish, that you can't put a bottle of water to your lips and drink it throughout the day. That simple task just to keep your body fresh and injury-free, then you're probably going to have a hard time in our culture.
Yeah, I like that last category quote, you're a bad guy. Tom, given the amount of coffee I've slammed this morning and I was just in the restroom, I'd fall in the category of worst guy ever based on the color. So I see you working.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is we're not throwing you out there in front of 105,000 people to play for us either.
That's the
Romy.
Truth. That is the truth. Also, WWE legend The Undertaker showed up at practice a few weeks back. What was it like meeting the dead man, the demon from Death Valley, in person, and how did he show up in front of the team?
Oh, man, it was... you know, very rarely in this business do you get starstruck, but I was a bit starstruck there, you know, a legend, you know, kind of growing up and in my youth. And so it was great just to hear his story. He came to us, actually. Michael Huff is on our staff, a former first round draft pick, and he lives in Austin, as many of our former players do. And his daughter, his like 6-year-old daughter, is on the same soccer team is the Undertaker's 6-year-old daughter. So if you can imagine the Undertaker attending 6-year-old girls' soccer games, that's probably a bit of a sight to behold. But his story is great. You know, he chose wrestling over basketball. He fell in love with it. He was literally, you know, sleeping in his pickup truck and paying places for him to actually compete. They weren't paying him to wrestle. He was paying them just to get video of him wrestling so that he could give the promoters and so on and so forth. And so it's just a great story of self-sacrifice to achieve your dreams and your goals. And I wanted him to convey that to the team.
You know, Tom, you mentioned family. Football is family. You mentioned that I have a family. Of course, you and I have talked in the past about your wife, Michelle. And in fact, the other day, you retweeted a couple of pictures from her, and the pictures were of things that she found while moving and cleaning out old boxes. They included notes that you had sent her when you were a graduate assistant in Texas, and a Texas pin that says, "My fiance is a GA." What do you remember about those days? And now, what's it like for the two of you, to be where you are right now?
Well, we had a lot less stress back then, I can tell you that.
For sure.
But we, you know, I was in love, and I hope she was too. You know, and really at the end of the day, not much else mattered. And whether, I was in Texas, and, you know, she was living in Manhattan Beach at the time and working in downtown L.A. and helping me pay rent, quite frankly, here in Austin to pursue my dreams of being a coach. And, you know, to see 19 years later that we're back here at our dream job in our dream city of Austin is it's very surreal. And when you look at it like that, I mean, the one that gets me and I think gets her every time is the one where I say, I can't wait for you to see where I'm at and how proud I was to be at the University of Texas and how much I wanted to share that with her. And, you know, I get to do that all over again 19 years later on a much different level.
It's so good. And then a final thought, you and she have had this amazing journey to get where you are, and we've talked about it in the past, but some of this has taken on an almost mythical level. As an example, is it true that you were once fired from Subway for hanging out in a walk-in refrigerator slamming pastrami? True or not true?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it was something out of a movie. I fell in love with it. I'd never really eaten pastrami. I didn't know what it was until I got the job at Subway. I was only there for a couple months, I believe, and I was, I mean, slamming it, Romy. You know, it was in the little plastic, you know, those clear plastic little bins that they have, and it was nighttime, and we were supposed to be putting them away and back in the fridge, and I decided to take a couple handfuls for myself, and the door opens and it's the owner like staring me in the face. I got pastrami hanging out of my mouth, you know, it's like the record stops, you know, the screeching record. And the only thing he said to me, if I remember right, was get out. And I got out and he told me never to come back and I never came back.
That is incredible. Yeah. But what about that? All right. So look, you were hungry. Who wouldn't do that? Prior to getting fired, how were you as a Subway employee or as you call it, a subcontractor? How were you then, before that happened?
Romy, I feel like, you know, it was one of the greatest injustices, and I brought it upon myself, certainly. But I feel like I had the potential to be one of the best submarine manufacturers the world has ever seen. And you know, unfortunately, I derailed my career as a subcontractor really before it could get off the ground.
John Wertheim is my guest. So, John, you wrote a piece for SI on Japanese baseball star Shohei Ohtani, and you also did a profile on him for 60 Minutes that I thought was fascinating. He is a fascinating athlete, but for those who don't know him, John, who is he and how would you describe him in a sentence or two?
He is the best pitcher in Japanese baseball. He's the best hitter in Japanese baseball. And they let him do both. Now the question is whether a major league team will do the same.
Okay, so we'll break that down in a minute. But if you go back a little bit, his father played semi-pro baseball, but he had his career cut short by a shoulder injury. And then when Shohei started playing baseball, he was actually very methodical about taking steps to improve, whether it was eating a dozen bowls of rice per day to bulk up or keeping spreadsheets of his goals. So when did people first start to notice that he could be a special player?
You know, he's a big kid. I mean, he's built like a quarterback. He's about 6'4", 220. And when he was in high school, he was already throwing, you know, he was throwing 100 as a 17-year-old. As an 18-year-old, he tells Japanese teams, listen, don't draft me. I'm going to go play in the majors. He'd mentioned the Dodgers as a team he'd come closest to signing with. And it looked like he was going to come, you know, over here. And at the last minute, the team that he plays for now, the Nippon Ham Fighters, where Yu Darvish had been their pitcher and he had left and they had a spot in the rotation, ends up staying in Japan. That was 4 years ago. But he's been on the radar of major league teams, you know, for 5-6 years now.
John Wertheim joining us. So lay that out for me. He could have skipped baseball in Japan, as you point out. He could have come straight to the U.S., but he stays with the Nippon Ham Fighters instead. Why was that?
The Nippon Ham Fighters said, you know what, you're a good pitcher and you like hitting too. Why don't you keep doing that over here? And I think he was under the impression that if he came to the Dodgers or he came to a major league team, they were going to use him as a pitcher and a pitcher only. He, you know, he throws right and he bats left, so he's leading into every. I mean, the guy's a tremendous hitter. I mean, even just in BP, I mean, the guy's going yard one out of every, you know, three pitches. But, you know, he's leaning in with his pitching arm, and I think the thinking was the major league team's going to, you know, pay big money for a pitcher. They're not going to let him risk, you know, getting 300-400 at bats a season. So anyway, then the Nippon Ham Fighters say, listen, keep doing both. Let's see how it goes. And that's basically what they've done. He's played the field, and nobody could decide whether it was for his pitching or his hitting. I mean, that's how good his batting is.
John Wertheim joining us. All right, so I want to go back to that in a minute. But as a pitcher, as an example, how does he compare to, say, one of his idols, Yu Darvish?
Everyone there said, never mind the at this age discussion. I mean, just in a vacuum, this guy's a better pitcher than Darvish is right now. I mean, he threw a pitch. I think it was 102.5, with 165 km. So he set the record for the fastest pitch in the history of Japanese baseball that broke his own record. And that was a few weeks after he also won the home run derby. But he throws, I mean, he's 22. He's still working on some mechanical stuff, and he's throwing over 102. You know, he can get to 99, 100, 101 pretty easy multiple times in a game. You know, the scouts say the hitting is the question mark, but right now he could be in any team's rotation tomorrow.
Right, so, I mean, the guy is obviously very unique. He's very special. I mean, to that point, there was a game last summer where he led off with a home run, then he pitched 8 shutout innings, and he struck out 10. He won the home run derby last year, and as you point out, he broke his own record for fastest pitch at 102.5 miles per hour. So what's he like as a teammate and as a person?
You know, the English is a work in progress, so all this went to a translator. He's a lovely kid. He's one of these guys who's, you know, he's very into his baseball. So he lives in the team dorm, and he practices, and then he goes home and he reads books about maximizing your workout. I mean, everything is really revolved around sports and baseball. He doesn't drink. The rumor is that no one confirmed officially, but the rumor is he spends about $1,000 a month as an allowance. And otherwise, you know, he lives at the team dorm. He plays baseball. He doesn't own a car. The cab takes him to games. We all roll our eyes cynically when we hear it's not about the money. But any 22-year-old, never mind an athlete, any 22-year-old that can live on $1,000 a month has got to be living pretty sparsely. But he's a great kid. I think the one thing that's cool about this story is he's got the leverage. Like he holds the cards. And if a team says, listen, if we're going to start plopping down, you know, 8 figures a year for you to be our pitcher, we don't need you playing, we don't need you taking at bats. He's in a position now where he's like, all right, you know what, I don't think you're the team for me. So there have been other pitchers, of course, that have wanted to do this. He's in a position where he can make it a condition of his signing.
Yeah, right. Sometimes you have the hammer, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have to wait for them to pick you, and sometimes you pick them. And John, go back to that point about the money. To what you just said, he lives in a team dorm. He lives off about $1,000 a month that his parents send him, and he doesn't even spend all that. He's named the player of the game. If that happens, he gets a free bag of rice or some salmon or some asparagus, which, as you point out, he likes because that means he doesn't have to go to the store. But what about the money? By not coming to the major leagues, and especially with a new CBA going down, how much did it cost him to stay where he is right now? Reports are up to $100 million. Lay that out for us. Why is it, and why did he stay?
It is not. I mean, I think the $100 million, I think that's probably a low-end estimate. I mean, if he had come here, we're just, you know, think about what we pay a decent starting pitcher. I mean, look, Joe Darvish is, whatever, $11 million. Tanaka is closer to 20. And you're getting, you know, a middle-of-the-order hitter. There's a new rule in the new collective bargaining agreement saying that overseas players under 25, they are capped. So it depends on whether you're a revenue club or not. It's complicated CBA. So the bottom line is he could not make more than about $6 million if he came now. If this were 6 months ago, he's a regular free agent. And he also has to play 5 years before he can negotiate as a free agent. So if he had done this, we were having this conversation a year ago, the sky's the limit. Right now, unless they can figure out a loophole to this collective bargaining agreement clause that was put in, and a lot of people speculate was put in foreseeing his arrival, there's a real limit on how much he can make. I mean, again, he downplayed, I asked him this multiple times, and he really downplayed it. It's not about the money and setting precedent, and he just wants to be happy playing baseball. But there's a lot of money that was impacted by this collective bargaining agreement clause.
Yeah. John, I always say it myself, but whenever somebody says it's not about the money, it's about
exactly.
One thing, the money. Except with this guy, I think you're right. Now, you mentioned that he could pitch right now in the major leagues, but as a batter, as an example, he had 22 home runs last year, and he had an OPS of 1.004. So my question is he a good hitter for a pitcher, or is he just a flat-out good hitter? In other words, is he Madison Bumgarner, or is he something better than that?
No, I mean, these guys are saying, I mean, he hit 22 home runs, but keep in mind that he wasn't batting in those games before. They rest him before the start. So I don't have it in front of me, but those 22 home runs came in you know, like 320 at bats. I think good hitter, great pitcher, and the consensus seems to be that the pitching is just, you know, again, major league level tomorrow, and the hitting is terrific in the Japanese league. Guys were telling me Japanese league, they call it 4A, so it's better than AAA, but not quite major league level. But he's got a really clean swing, and he hits for average. I mean, that one game, he was batting leadoff. So he hits a home run on the first pitch of the game, batting leadoff, and then he's your starting pitcher and, you know, throw the shutout. I would say the pitching is incrementally ahead of the batting, but he has no, I think he has no interest, but he has no sort of inclination to pick one. I mean, he wants to see this through and do both.
So a couple of quick things before you go. Are there any major leaguers, ex-major leaguers who are on his team? And if so, they've seen everything. What do they think about him?
Yeah, Brandon Laird was a guy we talked to a bunch who played for the Yankees. He said, this guy is the best player I've played with. Brandon Laird was on the Yankees with, you know, Jeter and Alex Rodriguez, played in the ass, came up with McCutcheon. He's like, I'm trust me, this guy is the best teammate I've ever had. And then we talked to Luis Mendoza, who's on the Nippon team and had played in the majors as a pitcher, and says, look, his stuff's as good as anyone in the majors. I think everybody sort of wants to see this through. I mean, it's such a cool, this is like a little leaguer's dream. I don't think I put this in, it's like a little leaguer's dream. You know, who doesn't want to hit the home run and then, you know, put your bat down, grab your glove and go strike out the side? And this guy's, he may not do it, but he's going to get the chance.
It's exactly what it is. It is like the little leaguer who is just blowing it by everybody and then mashing when he picks up the bat. The player we're talking about is Shohei Ohtani. So, John, last thought then. How many teams are interested in him? And then how do you think he'd fit in on a major league roster?
I think every team is interested. I think that, I mean, realistically, I think he's probably better suited for the American League. I mean, I'm not sure you want this guy as a corner outfielder, but I was talking about Luis, who had a really good point. He said, Mendoza, the major leader now with the team, he said, look, if you're in the National League and you've got to face this guy, if you're the pitcher, you're going to think really, you know, you're going to think twice about coming hard on him, knowing the next inning he can take the mound and throw 100 miles an hour at you. I think realistically, the American League makes more sense, but every single team has got this guy on their radar.
So final thought, if he wants to do both things, what do you think? Do you think it'd be enough for him just to pick up the bat as a DH, or does he want a cap and a glove as well to play the field when he's not pitching?
Yeah, he's a DH now, and I think that makes more sense. I mean, he said physically it's not a, I'm thinking you don't want your ace crashing into walls and trying to throw guys out at the plate. I think it's more of a mental strain, and he'd rather just grab a bat and, you know, one every nine guys get up to the plate than get in the glove and, you know, sit in the sun and, you know, in a hot day in St. Louis. I think for mental, not physical reasons, he's okay DHing.
Thank you very much for listening. You know this drill. Hit subscribe, tell a friend, trust the podcast. Enjoy the start of the NHL playoffs. Check back tomorrow for more Daily Jungle. We'll see you then.